Section 1. You will hear a conversation between a man and a woman as they discuss a holiday. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 5. You will see that there is an example. This time only, the conversation relating to this will be played first.
Good morning. My name is Keith Waters. I'm interested in finding out about certain type of holiday. Would you be able to help me with that?
Welcome to Sunshine Tours Agency. My name's Penny. Yes, I'm sure I can help you with that. What exactly are you thinking about?
My wife and I are interested in a cruise of the Mediterranean.
So, cruise is the correct answer. Now the full test will begin. You should answer the questions as you listen, as the recording is not played twice. Listen carefully to the conversation and answer questions 1 to 5.
Good morning. My name is Keith Waters. I'm interested in finding out about certain type of holiday. Would you be able to help me with that?
Welcome to Sunshine Tours Agency. My name's Penny. Yes, I'm sure I can help you with that. What exactly are you thinking about?
My wife and I are interested in a cruise of the Mediterranean.
That's a nice idea. A cruise on a ship in the Mediterranean is very popular right now. Can I take some basic details from you first, so I can work out what kind of cruise might suit you?
Of course.
So, your name is Keith Waters, and your wife's?
Her name is Melissa Waters.
Would you spell Melissa for me?
It's M-E-L-I-S-S-A.
And it's just you and your wife?
That's right. We don't have any children.
Okay, let me make a note of that. Fine. Now, how old are you both?
I'm 32, and my wife's 30.
Thank you. Now I'd like to ask about your interests and hobbies. This will help in choosing the right cruise for you.
We're both keen on traveling, of course. That's why we'd like to go on a cruise. We're also quite sporty. We both swim and jog quite a lot. We're interested in cinema and history. Melissa is also a keen fiction reader, but I prefer nonfiction.
What kind of budget were you thinking about?
We can spend between $7,000 and $11,000 on the trip. As cheap as possible, of course, is best.
Right. I've got all that down. Now, I need to know when you'd like to go on your cruise and for how long.
Our holiday window starts on the 1st of July and ends on the 16th of July.
Okay.
And as for length, we'd like to have at least 14 nights on the ship.
Thank you. I'm sure that'll be possible.
Before the conversation continues, you have some time to look at questions 6 to 10. Now listen carefully and answer questions 6 to 10.
Right. I've got all that down and I've got some ideas for you.
I'll just make some notes while I listen, if that's all right.
Of course. So, we have two boats that fit the dates you want. They sail on different dates, so that gives you some flexibility. First of all, I'd like to suggest the cruise on the boat the Maria Cristina. It's a Spanish boat and you'd fly to Barcelona to join her. The cruise from there costs $10,500 for both of you, although the flights to get to Barcelona will be extra. With that, you have all food and drinks free during the voyage. You get an inside cabin, which means that you don't get a sea view, but you can upgrade to a sea view for a further $800. They have a cinema on board with different films every night, and there are also lectures on the places where you will be visiting. There are also classes that you can do. For example, painting, cooking, art appreciation, and others.
That's just in our budget, but an upgrade would put us over.
Yes, you'd have to do without the upgrade. Travel insurance is incorporated within the price, though.
What about the next one?
That's the Sea Queen. This is also a Spanish boat, but it sails from Marseille in France and follows the same route as the Maria Cristina. Barcelona is the last stop before arriving back in Marseille. This costs $9,000 for both of you, but this includes the return flights to Marseille. With this package, you do get a sea view, and food is inclusive throughout the voyage. All drinks excluding water are extra, though. There are fewer things going on. There is a cinema, but there are no lectures or classes. There is a swimming pool and gym, though, so you'll be able to keep up with your exercise.
That's quite a lot of information, so I'd better get back and speak to my wife. She can come back here with me in 2 days, so I'll expect we'll have chosen which boat to go on by then. We can talk further details when we come in then.
That's great. See you in 2 days.
Yes, see you soon.
That is the end of section one. You will now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section two. Section two. You will hear a man and a woman on a radio program as the man gives an information talk on a reading charity. First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 15. Now listen carefully to the information talk and answer questions 11 to 15.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Radio Star, your local radio station. Today we are joined by Jake Matthews, who is part of the Read for All charity. He is coming today to tell us a little bit about it. Welcome, Jake.
Thanks, Marianne.
So, tell us all about Read for All, Jake.
Well, as the name implies, we are a charity that is focused on ensuring that all children have access to appropriate reading books. It has long been acknowledged that reading is an essential part of education while growing up, and children who read a lot do better at school than their peers who do not read a lot. Our plan starts when children are very young, so of course we therefore need to aim at parents, and chiefly low-income parents, to educate them about the benefits to their children if they are read to. Many children who read a lot develop this love of reading when their parents read to them. If we can get this happening, then more children will grow up with an attachment to reading that will affect them positively for the rest of their lives.
How do you educate the parents?
Our key focus is at hospitals where children are born. We have plenty of leaflets about us, and we have volunteers who visit the areas where parents are in hospitals and distribute these leaflets. Other places where we distribute our leaflets are nurseries, kindergartens, and primary schools, when parents drop off or pick up their children. The parents can then read about the benefits of reading in our leaflets and also see how we can help.
How can you help?
Good question. We realise that one of the things that stops parents reading to their children is that they do not know which books to read or where to find them. Families on budgets also find it difficult to allocate money to this area of family life when things are so tight. Getting parents to think about these things is also hard if the parents are not readers themselves. If we can get parents to come to our centre or website, we can tell them how to find books at no cost through joining libraries, or they can take away free books that we manage to print at a very low cost. All our books are graded by age, and there are no issues with breaking copyright, as we have permission to use all of them. Also, we have a low-cost app that people can download to their smartphone, as it seems even low-budget families can afford to own smartphones. It only costs a dollar, and with the app, stories and books can be downloaded for free, and the stories can either be read by the parent or read by a recorded voice. Of course, we try and encourage the parents to do the reading because of all the added benefits that this brings. This has already been a huge success, and we believe that there are now thousands more parents reading to their children than when we started. This will make such a difference to the children's imagination and English skills. Linked to this, immigrant families can read or listen to the stories, and both the parents' and children's English can be improved.
You now have some time to look at questions 16 to 20. Now listen to the rest of the information talk and answer questions 16 to 20.
How do you fund all these activities?
We only manage to operate because of generous donations. We get no official help. We have one particular donor who supplies the funding for at least 60% of our needs, but the rest all comes from the public. We have various ways that we try to raise funds. We run car boot sales, special dinners, and other similar activities. We also ask people who use our products a lot to make a modest and optional donation, if they can afford it.
Do you get enough money each year then?
Not always. Sometimes we make a little more than we need and sometimes a little less, but at present it all evens out in the end. We'd do better with more money though.
I'm sure many of our listeners would be keen to help out. How can they find out how to get money to you?
Thanks very much for the suggestion. We have a website called readforall.com. There is an icon on the homepage labelled Donations. If any of your listeners click on that, they will see the process of how to make a donation. This will probably be more convenient than sending money by mail or trying to find one of our centres. Thanks very much to anyone who does this.
I'm sure you'll get a good response.
I'd like to tell you now a little about volunteering, as we've received some questions about that.
Of course.
We cannot afford to pay a salary to anyone who comes to do any work for us, although sometimes we can pay for some modest expenditure incurred for travel from where people live to our centres if we can get receipts. This will all be explained in our volunteer leaflets that can be picked up at our centres or found on the website, but I just wanted to make this clear up front. Now I'd like to let people know about where to come if they'd like to volunteer. The best place is to come to our town centre offices. To get there, you need to travel to the city centre and go down Ballard Street, which comes off the roundabout in the town centre. Go down Ballard Street and take the second right. You'll recognise the turning as there's a cinema on the corner. Across Ballard Street from it, there is a police station. So you go down the road on this turning for around 100 metres. On the left are our offices above a car dealership. It's pretty easy to find us. If you come by car, you can park on the street, and there are, of course, lots of buses that go to the town centre. If you can't find us, give us a call or ask for directions to the main town post office, which is right opposite our offices.
That is the end of section 2. You will now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section 3. Section 3. You will hear a university teacher and three of his students discussing the students' upcoming economics essays. First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 25. Now listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 25.
Good morning, Mr. Stevenson.
Good morning, Amy. Are William and Anna with you?
They're just coming. Here they are.
So, good morning. Now we're all here, let's begin. You've all got your extended economics essays due in next month, and so we're meeting here today to discuss your progress. So, Amy, tell me a little about your essay.
Well, it's going fine, Mr. Stevenson. I chose to examine how global oil prices have affected the car industry.
That's a good subject at the moment. Those price fluctuations are creating some very unexpected results. Have you had any problems with gathering enough information to shape your essay?
Oh, yes. As you said, it's very topical at the moment and everyone seems to be writing about it. I've more than enough information. Actually, my main headache is with my sources. I don't have much experience with an essay of this type, and I'm not used to creating the citations in the correct way.
Yes. The first time that people write an essay at this level, they often have problems with sources. Once you've done a few essays here, you'll learn what to do and you won't have any further problems. We try to help students with this area on our website. where we have a guidance sheet that details all the procedures that you'll need.
Oh, good. I'll check that out.
Now, how about you, William? You're writing about the Australian fishing industry, aren't you?
Things are pretty good, thanks, Mr. Stevenson. I'm not writing about the fishing industry anymore, though. That was my original choice, but I found that the sources weren't very good for that.
Really? I thought lots would have been written about that.
Well, yes, a lot has been written, but not an awful lot recently. Because there was a shortage in fish stocks around 10 years ago, most writers have focused on that, which means that today's normal situation doesn't attract much attention. Because of that, I decided to write about the effects of immigration on employment figures in the Northern Territory state in Australia.
And things are going fine, you say?
Yes, I've got plenty of up-to-date sources, but I have a problem with length. I seem to have gone about 2,000 words over the 4,000 word limit. I've reviewed my content, and everything I've written is relevant, and there's nothing to cut.
Writing too much is a common problem with essays as well. What I can suggest is that you work on the task of revision. Most people find that they are very wordy in their first drafts, and things can be expressed in a much better way with fewer words. I've no doubt that you'll be no different. It will be quite time-consuming, but go through your work sentence by sentence. You'll soon find the length of your essay will soon be acceptable.
You now have some time to look at questions 26 to 30. Now listen to the rest of the discussion and answer questions 26 to 30.
That just leaves you, Anna. How's your essay going?
Not so well, I'm afraid, Mr. Stevenson. I've had lots of problems getting started because other essays were due for other teachers. When I was finally ready to start your essay at the beginning of this month, I got ill and I spent quite a few days in bed. I even went home to my parents' house so I could recover properly.
Oh dear, that's quite serious. Do you think you'll be able to submit the essay by the deadline?
I don't know. I'm finding it hard to settle down and put in the amount of work needed to do a good job. I find the library distracting because of all the people coming and going, and my housemates are too noisy to allow me to concentrate when I'm at home.
Maybe you could come to my special evening work sessions. It's just at quiet time when students who find it hard to work independently at home or in the library can work without being disturbed. I'll be there as well, so if you have any questions, you'll have no delay in getting an answer.
That's a good idea, Mr. Stevenson, but what I really need is an extension, so that I can really do a really good job on the essay.
That shouldn't be a problem, Anna, but we have to follow the department rules on that. They specify that you need to supply a doctor's note for what you're asking for. If you can do that, then I will fill in the application form for you and approve it.
Oh, I didn't think of that. I'll need to go back and ask for it.
It shouldn't be a problem. Doctors in this town are used to providing them to support extension applications for students.
Okay.
Now, are there any other problems about the essay?
Well, there are a few things. I'm still not sure about a good subject. I was looking at a couple of things and I found good resources on both of them. My first idea was looking at how tax breaks offered by the Australian government can stimulate overseas investment.
That sounds as though it has possibilities.
Yes, but it got rather overcomplicated, as tax often is, apparently.
So what else have you thought about?
I was stuck for quite some time. I researched a lot in the library and online, but as I said before, I found it hard to concentrate.
You should have come to see me. I told you at the start that it was fine to get advice from me for choosing a topic.
I know, I just felt I should do it on my own. In the end, I looked at a historical overview of imports and exports between Australia and New Zealand. It would mean I would have to travel to New Zealand to check resources there, but my dad said he'd pay for that. I also could avoid having to deal with tax, which would be a bonus.
That's certainly more straightforward, yet should also be academic enough to fulfil the requirements of the essay.
It is, but I found the subject rather boring. My first topic was more complex, but much more interesting.
Well, let's let the others go and we can discuss your topics now and make sure that you've chosen one by the end of our time.
Okay, thanks so much, Mrs. Stevenson.
That is the end of section 3. You will now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section 4. Section 4. You will hear a lecture on the signature. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Now listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40.
Hello everyone. Today in this lecture, we're going to look at the signature and how today the e-signature has developed. In a culture of literacy and documentation, people obviously have always needed reliable ways to identify themselves and to be identified by others. This could be for creating charters, contracts or wills, or for witnessing a document. Signing one's name by hand on paper has become the authoritative convention for this, and one that is closely aligned with our own sense of identity. In addition, signatures are important in legal documents, since by signing a paper document, the contents can become enforceable against the signatories. The Sumerians, in the 5th to the 3rd millennia BC, are considered the originators of writing, and these ancient people also developed ways of authenticating who wrote things. The Sumerians created seals, or intricate works of art carved in clay tablets, to identify possession. In many civilizations throughout history, people have used symbols and other marks to authenticate or acknowledge writings and drawings, and even to accept the contents of documents. The earliest actual handwriting signature we have has been traced to the year AD 439, and is attributed to the Roman Emperor Valentinian III. Signatures are connected with graphology, which is the study and analysis of handwriting, especially in relation to human psychology. Graphology is a science originated in the mid-1600s, when an Italian professor, Camillo Baldi, wrote a book about how one can learn about a person's character and personality by looking at his writing. After the book was published, the study acquired a large following and spread widely. The Frenchman Jean Michon became the first to use the term graphology, applying two Greek words to describe the new study: grapho, meaning to write, and logos, meaning knowledge. Michon's contribution to graphology is immense. He formed graphological societies, published magazines, and founded an academy for the subject. His approach was rather uncomplicated. He would study only the separate written elements instead of a more complex approach. The method implied that presence of one graphological feature indicates a certain trait of character, whereas its absence implies the opposite feature. Not all his students and successors would accept Michon's method, though all agree that handwriting is a way of indicating personality. Wilhelm Preyer, child psychologist, wrote in 1895 that writing originates in the brain, not in the fingers, and that handwriting is actually brain writing. This premise underlines how graphologists believe that a person's handwriting mirrors his or her thoughts. Signatures were of particular interest to graphologists, but technology may now have made the handwritten signature obsolete. Technology companies in the 1980s and 1990s created instruments that let businesses send signed contracts across the globe in seconds. These technologies, now known as fax machines, email, and the World Wide Web, were considered major breakthroughs at the time. However, many people still questioned whether contracts that were signed and shared via fax, email or internet would hold up in court. This led to what has become known as the electronic signature. In law, the one indispensable characteristic a signature has to possess is that it must physically add something to the document and that the signature will leave a physical mark or trace upon its surface. Electronic documents do not satisfy this condition, and the signature, like any alteration to an electronic document, does not leave a trace, or if it does, it is at such a microscopic level that it is in practice invisible. It looks nothing like the marks that have been accepted in law as constituting a handwritten signature. In 1996, the United Nations looked into the topic of e-signatures and developed a framework with the purpose of encouraging e-commerce by providing a series of internationally acceptable rules. These rules removed many of the obstacles that had prevented foreign businesses from conducting electronic transactions in the past and ensured that electronic contracts would legally receive equal treatment to paper contracts going forward. Many online businesses work with a click-to-agree basis. However, the desire for and utility of a handwritten, unique electronic signature is still apparent. Such a tool acts to enhance legal verification and adds a human touch to otherwise impersonal electronic documents and business deals. To fill this gap, lots of electronic signature software can now include options for the signer to provide a hand-drawn personal electronic signature.
That is the end of section 4. You will now have half a minute to check your answers.